Our fine city has changed a great deal over the years. Michael Cole was a young TV reporter on the fledgling Anglia TV, and he recalls life lived at a more leisurely pace.
There was always something in the air of Norwich 53 years ago. On Shrove Tuesday, 1967, it was a hint of spring. My fiancée, Jane, and I were enjoying after-work drinks with six friends in a flat in Brackendale, when someone stupidly suggested a pancake race. Batter was quickly whipped up, frying pans were found, and eight of us ran madly up and down the street outside for half an hour until laughing tired us out. The point being that there was no traffic. At 6:30 in the evening, everyone had gone home. Norwich had gone to sleep. Not one vehicle came along Brackendale, the main southeast route out of the city, to spoil our silly stunt for 30 minutes. Norwich was a different place then, not sleepy exactly, but certainly a county town where life proceeded at a stately pace. I had just joined the Eastern Daily Press, its offices then in Redwell Street. I would look out of the reporter's room window at the church opposite, one of Norwich's 52 churches for every Sunday of the year, it was said. The church had a handsome clock. Its blue face bears the words, "Forget me not." Norwich took that warning to heart, because everything seemed to happen with a steady regularity. Every morning at 11, the air would be heavily scented with chocolate. The Roundtree Macintosh factory, now the site of Chapelfield Shopping Centre, was concocting its latest consignment of confectionery, another 500,000 Kit Kat fingers rolling off the production line. On Wednesdays, the heady aroma of hops and malt barley trumped the chocolate. Norwich Brewery was producing its latest batch of beers, sending up a fragrant cloud that hung over the city like a drunkard's dream. But social habits were already changing, and the beer trade was feeling the draught. The city's two biggest breweries, Bullard's and Stewart & Patterson's, had recently closed down. I later covered the last brew in Great Yarmouth at Lakin's Brewery, the name recently and happily reborn, and the final mash at the S&P Brewery in Ely. Norwich had once boasted 365 pubs, one for every day of the year, which made me wonder what happened on leap years. Pubs were closing, but the Norwich Club seemed a fixture. It was hidden at the end of a narrow passage off London Street. Alfred Munnings, my favourite painter, had once been a member. Playing snooker one evening, Munnings heard a visitor spouting what in Norfolk had always been called a load of old squit, and the man was loudly asserting that it was impossible to create art unless conditions of calm and silence prevailed. Well, to prove the man wrong, Munnings ripped down two of the club's blackout blinds and, using his billiard chalk, rapidly drew two animated scenes, one of a prancing white horse and the other of the circus with clowns, favourite subjects of his. Years later, the Munnings blinds, complete with the stitching down the sides, were sold for a lot of money. Diagonally opposite the Norwich Club was Austin Reed, where you could have your hair cut while considering swatches of cloth for your new bespoke suit. Veteran barber had worked for decades in the fabulous Art Deco barber shop in the basement of Austin Reed's Regent Street HQ in London. As he worked, he mentioned the rich and famous men whose locks he had trimmed and whose chins he had shaved. I wrote up the celebrity barber of London Street for the paper. I applied to join About Anglia as its staff reporter. Auditions were being filmed on the Castle Mound. Somehow, the briefing notes had not reached me. No matter, I busked some information I'd recently gleaned about the plans to create a bigger and better museum within the castle keep. I got the job. I started on Whit Monday. I took the train from Lowestoft, where I was living in a flat above Jane's charming dress shop, next to the station, to Norwich. I walked up Prince of Wales Road to begin 22 years as a television reporter. The news editor, Jim Wilson, handed me a piece of paper with a name and address on it, "Now, Michael," he said, "for your first job, I want you to go there and interview that man." I read the note, screwed it into a ball and threw it into the waste paper bin. "What are you doing?" asked Jim, clearly thinking that he'd hired a lunatic. "Well," I replied, "you're winding me up, aren't you, to test the new boy? That address is the building in Lowestoft that I left an hour ago to travel 27 miles to start this job. And of all the places in East Anglia, you're really sending me back there?" He was. It was also the address of the Lowestoft Chamber of Commerce. Its chairman was complaining about all the bridges being closed whenever a prisoner escaped from Blunderston Prison, which was often. I returned to Lowestoft and conducted my first television interview. When it was transmitted, Dick Joyce, the West Raynham farmer who became the face of Anglia when launched in 1960, walked across the studio. "Don't stand with your hand in your pocket like that for the wide shots," he said. "It looks ugly." It was the only advice I was ever to receive on how to be a TV reporter. I never put my hand in my pocket on television again. If you worked for Anglia then, you were truly a prince of the city. Presenters like Bob Wellings, Dick Graham, John McGregor were huge stars. Colin Ewing's farming programme set the agricultural agenda. Romper Room transfixed the nation's ankle biters. John Bacon, white hair parted with a ruler, presented the regional news with all the gravitas of the family solicitor reading out a will. Anglia was licking its wounds from the failure of Weaver's Green, its TV attempt at the Archers, but it remained a full-service regional station. Its drama was well regarded. The pioneering wildlife series Survival was a huge success, the brainchild of Anglia's chief executive, Aubrey Buxton, major Essex landowner and pal of the Duke of Edinburgh. "Mr. Buxton spoke to me only once. It was Sunday. I was on duty alone when shocking and entirely unexpected news came over the Press Association wire. Anglia had lost its transmitter at Belmont, serving Lincolnshire and Humberside. The Independent Television Authority had awarded Belmont to a new company, to be called Yorkshire Television. Mr. Buxton rang the newsroom. I broke the bad news that Anglia would now lose a third of its viewers. I must say he took it calmly, seasoned perhaps by wartime service in Burma, where he was awarded the Military Cross. I was proud to be a small part of Anglia TV. It wasn't a part of the region I didn't cover, racing at breakneck speeds back to Norwich to get the film processed for broadcast at 6. In the whole of East Anglia, there was then not a single mile of dual carriageway, if you didn't count the divided seafront known as Great Yarmouth's Golden Mile, which I didn't. I was always in a hurry, but not everyone was. The newsroom would usually be deserted at lunchtime. Journalists had their own stools at the bar in the Royal Hotel opposite. This permitted the young woman in charge of Grams, music needed with mute film, to play her favourite records very loud on the expensive equipment in the rafters of Anglia House, where the newsroom was located. She loved Sunny and would dance to it all alone, as I once chanced to see. Anglia's live music was provided by Peter Fenn and the Fenn Men. He was chairman of the Norwich branch of the Musicians Union and spent hours trying to convince me that communism was a good idea, without success. The Royal still took guests. Norwich really had only two hotels of note, the historic Maid's Head, opposite the main gate of the cathedral, and the Castle on Castle Meadow, the businessman's rest. The nearby Bell Hotel was an historic coaching inn, but it didn't meet the demands of the 1960s. The playwright Arnold Wesker had toiled in its kitchen and captured it all in The Kitchen. His play Roots drew upon his time working on a farm near Harleston. Bonds at the top of Timber Hill closed all day on Monday. Half-closing was Thursday in Norwich, and most shops closed for lunch. Life was ordered, and time moved slowly. Norwich was 99% white. The only place you would ever see diversity was at the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, then just beyond the old city walls on the New Market Road, or at the new university. Golfers were still bitter in 1967 that the famous architect Dennis Lansdowne's grandiose student residences had been built across the fairways they loved at Earlham Golf Club. It was a mistake not to build the University of East Anglia in Norwich. It could have filled the big vacant site between King Street and Burr Street, creating an instant Cambridge feel, with its students bringing new life into the city. What happened ensured that most Norwich people are unaware of the university, and many students never go into Norwich. Most early students, like Selina Scott, lived in the converted RAF barracks at Horsham St Faith's, and spent half their time on buses. Norwich Airport wasn't even a pipe dream. Jimmy Crampton, who later founded Norfolk Airways with local flying legend Wilbur Wright, flew me and my Anglia camera crew around East Anglia in a single-engine Cessna 172. Jimmy, who flew Wellington bombers in the Second World War, would arrive for takeoff riding his bike and wearing an overcoat and bicycle clips, which he kept on while he flew. Sometimes we landed on the beach at Cleethorpes. I was thrilled. Norfolk Airways became Air Anglia and then Air UK, Britain's right-hand airline, opening up routes to Leeds, Bradford, Edinburgh and Aberdeen, and then to Rotterdam and holiday destinations on the continent. Air UK was later taken over, but not before Jimmy and Wilbur had proved that Norwich Airport was a great idea. They'd started their partnership, flying holidaymakers on sightseeing trips over Yarmouth. Bishop of Norwich, Lancelot Fleming, had been a rower in his youth. One evening, idling with friends at the Wood's End pub at Bramerton on the River Yare, a rowing eight came past, the bishop pulling well. Another of the oars was the editor of the Eastern Daily Press and my former boss, Alf Jenner. We cheered. There was not much vice in Norwich then. Rose Lane was a low-voltage red-light district because it had few shops and even fewer neighbours to complain. A few battle-weary prostitutes would take up position at dusk, spaced like parking meters, although Norwich was one of the few cities not to deploy those silent sentinels of local tax collection then. Cash-for-sex transactions tended to take place under the railway bridge at Troce, within sight of the new Norfolk Police Headquarters, which showed a bit of insouciance on the prostitute's part. Norwich City Police had recently been subsumed in the new Norfolk County Force. One of the city police inspectors had secured the job of security at Anglia House, and his name was Mr. Tester. He made my life hell, going out of his way to reprimand me if I ever parked in the wrong place or entered a door-marked exit. Mr. Tester regarded me as the lowest form of Anglia life. One day, I was in reception, waiting to meet an interviewee, when Barbara Cartland arrived in her Rolls-Royce to appear on the afternoon show. Miss Cartland, a veritable pink meringue in a large matching hat, waited majestically on the sofa provided. At that moment, Mr. Tester happened to walk across reception with his customary military swagger, the brass buttons of his uniform tunic gleaming. Spotting this imposing figure, Barbara Cartland called out, "Porter, Porter, come here." Mr. Tester froze. "What did you call me, madam?" he asked. "Porter," she replied. Mr. Tester visibly shook. "Madam," he said, "I am the head of security." "Then why are you dressed like a porter?" she asked. It was my best moment at Anglia. That is, until September the 11th, 1967, when Jane and I were married at St. Mary's Church, Summer Leighton, and the film of our wedding ran on about Anglia. We're still together 53 years this month.